Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We have a very special guest, a legend in the game, Salisbury coach Jim Berkman, announcing his retirement this week. Not many people match the career that Coach Jim Berkman has had. Coach, first of all, congrats on everything you've accomplished and congrats on retirement.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, it's been a good run. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of great players and be in a place that that gives you an opportunity to win and the support to do it. And I've had a lot of great players that have stayed around here to help me coach over the years, especially and a couple other guys that did join into the family that were so instrumental. But we've always had a lot of guys give back that have really helped make the difference here.
38-year career at the helm of Salisbury University. Coach, can you just talk about the decision to retire and why now and why it's the right time for you?
Well, first of all, a lot of people don't realize how old I am, you know. I'm going to be 67 in February. And I'm fortunate, you know, I've had a pretty good lifestyle my whole life. And, you know, I'm pretty active and fit. So a lot of people don't realize that, you know, a lot of people still think I'm in my late 50s or early 60s, you know, and it's kind of getting at the other end here. I had an interesting talk with Mike Winters, one of my former players, who's doing extremely well in the financial world. And he goes, Coach, you just got to remember the three stages. This talk was yesterday. He goes, you know, you're in stage one of retirement right now. You're in the go-go stage. And he said, you need to get on it because most people already got about a five-year head start on it. He says, but then it's going to turn into that slow-go stage. And then there's going to be the no-go. So let's get going and get out there and get some things done that you haven't done, you know, for the last 44, because I've been coaching college lacrosse for 44 years. I started the fall I graduated with Hank Jancic, you know, here as a grad assistant. But, you know, I think it's a few things, you know. I don't know in any one order. I think it's just the accumulation of a few things. You know, my wife's been retired for 5 years. You know, I got a child that works at Auburn, and I got a child that, you know, is vice president of True Lacrosse in Chicago. And that's what I call the vicious triangle, because it's 13 hours to Kyler, it's 13 hours to Kelly, and then Kelly to Kyler's 13 hours, you know, and I haven't made that triangle a whole lot over the last few years, with four grandchildren. So, you know, that's one thing for sure. Two or three, you know, is the last year, 18 months, I've had some health bouts that, you know, I'm over, but, you know, they definitely are concerning, you know, with the blood clotting thing issue I had. And, you know, I've had a heart attack 14 years ago and a couple other things that said, you know what? Probably the stress on the sideline and the stress every day, as you know, we've already played about 50 tournaments this summer, jumping in the car at 4 and driving to Baltimore in 2 hours and watching for 8 and driving home and fighting the bridge traffic, and is probably not the best for where I am in that part of my life. So all those things together, you know, I think says, you know what, it's time to go to the next chapter. First chapter has been a great run. I'm very proud of what I've accomplished and been very fortunate. And now I'd like to do a few things different, you know, in the next chapter.
Coach, and you always attacked it with a ton of energy. You know, 67, you certainly do not look 67 years old. I will give you that. I saw your wife post on Instagram, like a logo, Berkman Family Adventures. What adventures do you kind of have in plan?
Well, you know, You got to remember what a coach's life's like now, and it wasn't like this when we started 38 years ago. You know, I was kind of just joking with somebody the other day. You know, like, I'm looking forward to going on a 2 week vacation, because the last one that I went on a 2 week vacation was really early when I was the coach here, because there was 1 week then, not 2 weeks. There was 1 week of 205. There was 1 week at Top Star, and then there was 4-day adventure to the Empire Games. And then the rest of the summer was kind of yours as a coach, you know, and I remember being upstate New York when my son was young, and we were on Lake Ontario. We rented a cottage, and my family came down. And man, and if you've never really been on a 2-week vacation, it's so much different than a 1-week vacation, because a 1-week vacation is like, whoa, I got to do all this stuff. I got to, I'm on vacation, and I want to go there. I want to go do that. But man, when you kick into that second week, man, it's a whole different mindset, and it's like, whoa, things really do slow down. And then you do what you really want to do, but it's not like you're in a hurry. And I'm looking forward to some of those things. And with the summer the way it's been, and, we play so many more games now. You remember the first season I played here, we played 12 games, and then we were fortunate to get in tournament, and that was the 13th. Everybody's maxing out in D3 at the 17 games, because that's a recruiting attraction. And then you play a conference championship. Next thing you know, you're into 20-some games. Fall ball's gotten, increased. So, like, when you look at a coach's life in D3 at a very competitive program, whether it's us, RIT, or Tufts, and maybe not so much Tufts because they don't have the whole fall ball thing, you can count on one hand the weekends when there's a Saturday and Sunday together. Over 52 of those. It probably doesn't bother me as much as it definitely bothers the other part of your family.
That's for sure. I feel like this retrospective of like how recruiting has changed and how, just an evolution of the entire timeline is, really interesting. And along those lines, you're one of the most apt people in the sport to answer this question. It's like, give us a little insight as to how it's been to evolve the way that you've been able to coach kids that you had in the 90s to the way that you had to coach kids, in the 2000s to like the 2010s to 2020s to like now, which I imagine it's, a little bit different. And, there's just been things that you probably have had to do along the way to kind of change and, just adapt alongside.
Yeah. It's interesting. How that all has occurred and the player that you had, man, in the 90s, we had to get on the map. We were way behind, I showed up, I had 19 guys, I had 6 games on the schedule. It was supposed to have been 12. I started calling the coaches in the second week in August when I got the job, and the guy hadn't followed through with anything, and we had 6 games. And can you just imagine this day and age right now, if it's August 25th and I got 6 games going into the year, trying to find we might end up with 8,
Right.
And then we only had 19 players, and it was just a different world. But, I was fortunate at the beginning that Rick Berkman followed me, my nephew, from Canton, and, he ended up being a first team All-American and scoring 100 points. And then I got a couple other kids, Jeff Aberry and Dan Gorley, in the middle of the year. And so we were fortunate that the first year was okay. But then we had to find a niche. And at that time for me, the niche in the 90s was definitely the JUCO kids. JUCO was extremely competitive then because, I don't know what to quote me on this, but I think at that time we were only in 60-some Division III teams. But only 8 made the tournament too, remember. It was a little different. So the JUCOs played a more important role, in the transition, because there wasn't 240 Division III schools. And you had a lot, you had just some great players in JUCO in the 90s that, some guys went to Carolina and played. I mean, there was a lot of really good ones. And then you had Coach Worm, who was a dynasty coach at Herkimer, Coach Speckman at Nassau, and, Timmy Pools was the Essex coach. And so we were fortunate the second year, and, I don't know how I lucked out on it, but, I got Eric Unglick to come, who was the JUCO player of the year. And Eric was a crazy player. He was just unbelievable. And then every year for maybe the next 8 to 10 years, I got one or two kids from Herkimer. I got one from Nassau, a couple from Essex, and Anne Arundel wasn't bad then, too. And then I get an Anne Arundel kid, Chris Turner, player of the year. Then I still got, the biggest freshman class probably, ever. I get Jason Kaufman in, 92, and I get Chris McQueenie, and then you blend those guys together, And then all of a sudden, man, we're on the map quick. But that was a whole different group. You know, those kids were in junior college for a reason, you know. And so tough, you know, school probably wasn't a priority in high school. And now we got to mold, and we got to make them accountable. And, you know, we got to go to class. We got to write papers. And believe me, there's some interesting stories from the 90s to help to make those guys make it, man. And, you know, Chris Murphy from Anne Arundel ended up being a first team All-American from here. You know, his story is just unbelievable. And, you know, now he owns like 5 companies and he's a millionaire, you know. But for him to make it through college, you know, it was nothing short of a miracle, of, you know, being overachiever and helping him get to the right places. And, but, you know, then it's school's totally different now. You know, we're top 25% a business school in the country. You know, the average SATs are well over 1200. We're ranked as very, very competitive. Now we have a lot of really smart guys, you know, that you don't have to really worry a whole lot about the school part at all, who've come through the whole club system. Now, you got a 90s, remember, I had coached real hard a lot of times. You know, like, those guys were tough, and they'd been in a lot of places that a lot of our kids today have never been in. Right. You know, a lot of tough kids from New York. You know, now you're coaching kids that, you know, the club coach is telling them everything's okay, regardless of how bad it is. Right. Because he's got to make sure he gets his check next week, you know, and they sign up for the next season. So it makes me crazy when a guy makes 47 mistakes and he comes off and he's patting, it's okay, it's okay. You know, like, you know, well, that's not okay after 3 times. You know, that's not the way it works in this world. You know, if you guys are working for me and we're working on Wall Street, and 3 times you lose $1 million, you're probably not going to be around tomorrow. You know, so, you know, but in the same token, you know, I think that winning and respect and, you know, where I've been, I've probably been able to confront kids in a more positive way that can make them make changes in this day and age. Because when you walk in the wall and you see the championship trophies, maybe you ought to listen to that guy, you know. And you know what's amazing? This is truly amazing. I wished I could just put together these 400 texts or whatever I've had from all the players. And man, and you say, what's the one common theme? And you wouldn't believe it. Not one of them talks about winning.
Right.
Not one of them talks about winning. Coach, thanks for making me a man. Thanks for making me accountable. If it wasn't for you and what you did at that time in my life, we would not be where I am. You know, that's Eric Miller, that's Chris Murphy, that's Mike Winters, you know, guys that are just killing it in the financial world. And that story just kind of goes on and on. Jason Tarnow, you know, the new coach, John Carroll, that's coaches, you know, coach, if it wasn't for you and Jenny in the late 90s, I don't know where I'd be today. You know, there's another one ringing on my phone right now, Kevin Horner from, you know, Nassau, that's killing it in the sales world in Long Island. I mean, that just makes you freaking cry.
Like, yeah, it's really cool. Like that.
So you say, you know what? Maybe I freaking made a difference, you know, besides all those wins, man. I really made a difference. It validated, like, what you do. Like, it takes all this time because, you know, people are, they don't want to say that until, you know, like the end, you know, a lot of times.
So I'll jump in and kind of ask a follow-up question to all of that, which is like, I think that there are thousands of coaches out there that right now are trying to create a process that the byproduct is wins, right? You're creating a process that turns your 18 to 22 year olds from boys to men. And you hope that through the process of doing that, you end up winning some games along the way. So like, I guess the core of that is like, what are the keys to the process that you guys think that you've been able to instill along the way that's led to the byproduct of all those wins?
Well, I think when it all started, man, you know, I was a coach of St. Lawrence basketball before I came here for 3 years, and I actually still got this sweatshirt. I wish I could show you the sweatshirt. And it's still sitting in my sweatshirt thing. And it's like this basketball guy with his arms up like this. And he's got big biceps. And you can just tell it came out of the weight room. And it was when I was at St. Lawrence. And it just, the whole theme was that players are made, not born. And I've always, you know, I was a gym rat, you know, in college. I mean, Lonnie Webb, who was a, if you search Lonnie Webb, you'll see, man, the kid had an unbelievable career at St. Lawrence basketball, played at Mount Vernon, state championship. I played with Lonnie. He texted me yesterday and goes, Berkey, this doesn't surprise me at all. Man, you were the hardest working and had the best IQ on the team, you know, way back when we played ball together, you know, at St. Lawrence. I've always been like the overachiever, the guy that stays late, the guy that's always shooting basketball, you know. In my career at St. Lawrence, you know, I played basketball, so I never practiced lacrosse the first 3 or 4 weeks. But right after basketball practice, you go down to the, you know, field house and who's on the wall for 45 minutes after basketball practice. And, you know, we're in the NCAA tournament. It's Berkman throwing the ball against the wall. That's always kind of been my thing. And so when I got here, like, I always, right from day one, is like, players got to be made, not born. They got buy-in to doing what we call the edging stuff, the stuff outside of 3 to 5. You know, now in this day and age, everybody's doing that, right? Like, you can turn on anything. Everybody's doing that wall ball, and everybody's doing the extra shooting, and we got all these shooting coaches and all that stuff. Well, in the 90s, that wasn't happening. You know? I mean, in the 90s, if you looked at some of the lacrosse teams, I don't care if they were at Syracuse or whatever, and you take the guys that even played in the early 90s of Syracuse, man, they didn't even know where the weight room was, you know? And I got a lot of those guys to buy into that, doing that extra stuff, you know, and staying after and throwing balls. And we started to get guys that just kept improving when they got here, you know, and that became our mindset. We're going to outwork them. We're going to outwork them. We're going to do that. And we're going to, you know, and more of a culture of being accountable to each other, that, hey, all of us have to do this stuff. And when one guy doesn't, they pick up the other guy and they got it done. You know, that was critical. It was a lot of guys got a lot better here. You know, yeah. When you walk in the locker room here, you see three world team jerseys and 17 pro jerseys. Well, those guys didn't choose Salisbury over Syracuse and Virginia. You know, they got better while they were here because that became part of their life. And then, you know, learning to do those things, they really believed they could outwork anybody no matter what they did. And that carried on in life for a lot of them. But that was a big part, you know, and then continuity. You know, I'm a continuity guy, man. Like, I believe in consistency. I believe in a set format, a lot of great drills. You know, we're not changing the ship every day. You know, you come to one of our practices and you say, man, how do those guys get from one drill to the other in about 3 seconds? Because everybody knows the drill and the expectation that there's no downtime because, you know, our objective for 2 hours is to get the most amount of reps. But at the same token, it's a lot of fun. And we do a lot of small-sided drills. You're an offensive guy, man. You could score 45 goals today. You know, you get 45 shots on real goalies in the first half-hour practice. But everybody knows the drills. And then there's the loyalty part, you know, over time that you're fortunate because you stay at one place. And then there's the winning part. You know, people want to win. And that's why our sport, it's so hard for so many teams to break into it. It's just a traditional sport. It doesn't matter if it's Division III or if it's Division I. It's hard to break that gap of that top 8 or 9 schools because, you know, it's such a traditional thing. And those 8 or 9 programs have some more stuff than the other ones that are a pretty big attraction.
You know, you look back, 13 national titles, 678 wins, and it's 300 and something All-Americans. When you hear those sheer numbers, like, what do you feel when you hear that?
Well, you know, it obviously the number is unbelievable. But to think back at all those guys, it's like, holy cow. Again, fortunate to coach a lot of good guys, but there's some guys on that list that you might be most proud of. That a lot of people never thought would get on that list because they bought in to the culture that we created here, you know, and they got a lot better. You know, do you think anybody remotely thought Cross Ferrer coming out of Delaware was going. You ask his coach. Did his coach think coming out of high school he was going to be an All-American?
Right.
Man, I can remember Cross, and Cross and I are really good friends. Like, I get a text from the dude every morning, like, "Hey, Coach, I hope you're not sleeping again. You know, I've already lifted, done this," and I got texting back, say, "Well, I've already did my 100 push-ups, Cross," and you know, we go back and forth almost every day about something. And you know, he's been out of school for a couple years. But you know, when I can distinctively remember Cross standing next to me in prospect camp his junior year, talk about a skinny kid. He was just skinny. He didn't have anything, you know. And then he got the message a little bit that summer before his senior year, and so he started getting into it, man. And when he gets here, you know, I bet you when he's standing there next to me as a junior, he weighed 160-some pounds, you know, and he was 6'1", and next thing you know, the kid's 6'2", he graduates, he's 198, and he bench presses it 28 times. Now, how did that happen? Well, obviously, he's extremely motivated, but the culture that he was in, you know, helped him get to where he needed to be to get that opportunity. And he improved immensely every year, every year.
Coach, you've talked about this before, but that first title, you know, beating Hobart kind of on their way out, how important was that to the next, 30 years of your career?
Well, we should have won in 91. We absolutely should have won that game in 91. We had a great team. They had a great team. You know, they had a couple world team players on that team. And going into the game that week, it had been like 100 degrees every day. You know, we're playing on our home field back when it was, you know, a JV high school field. You know, the stands were right on top of you. The locker rooms were a concrete block house that, you know, housed the tractors, and they had to move them out so that we could sit in there before the games. And I said, man, we just got a little more depth than they do. You know, their first 10 is good. Our first 10 is good, but man, our depth's a little bit better than it was, which was hard to believe at that time. And then we get a storm like the night before the game. I mean, and it goes from like 95 degrees. I don't even think it was 55 during the game. It was like low 50s and it rained all night. And now it's cool and it's the weather's not, the heat's not even a factor in the game. And, you know, they were playing the sub game on every faceoff. This guy would come on, we put this guy on, they pull this guy out. You know, it was just amazing what was going, but they were playing almost with the same 10 the whole game, you know, and, but they could do it because it was a lot cooler. You know, and then Van Arsdale runs back to the goal. He's out of the goal, and we throw the ball into the goal, wide open net, and he reaches out with one arm, not even in the net, and saves the ball. And man, you know, we don't get to overtime. But we could have really won that game in 91, you know. And then, you know, lost a couple guys, rebuilt a little bit, and then in 94, we had a team, and we had a chance. And I think Hobart, if you look back, and don't quote me on this, but I think this is pretty accurate, because that was 32 years ago. I think they had just beaten Duke, like in their last game of the regular season to go before we went into the playoffs, you know, and everybody's thinking, oh yeah, they got, Hobart's got them again, you know, and it's going to win again. And then boom, we went, played a great game. We inverted a lot that game and that caused them some problems. You know, Tommy McAuliffe covered their star and shut him down. Eric Miller was great in the goal, and we beat him pretty good, 15-9. But that was good for us. I think it was good for Division III because, you know, the next year they were going D1 and everything, and people weren't going to say, oh yeah, when you won in 95, you know, the only reason you won in 95 or 98, Hobart's not here. You know, I think that was all good for that, for sure. And, but the, you know, there's a lot to be said to just getting the first one. I mean, ask Jay Kuhn, get the first one, changes the equation a little bit. You know, the mindset, the recruiting, you know, the effort, once people been there and they see it, you know, I always tell guys that, you know, that experience is one of the three best in your life. You know, the day you get married, the day you have a child, and then, you know, the day you play in a championship, man, those are the three best things in your whole life. And,
once you get there, man, talk about kids coming back and being inspired to go back and creating the culture that you wanted to do. It's a little bit easier to say, yeah, we need to do a little more wall ball. I want to get back, right? You know, they start to understand those things a little bit more. And then you keep going and going, and like, guys, it gets contagious. Like, it just, you know, it's amazing how it's contagious. I mean, in 2004 or five, I don't remember, there was one year we came back after winning championship and we lost a couple guys. I knew the first practice we were going to win the championship in fall. It's like, holy cow, we were really good last year, but man, we're already better in the first day of fall ball than we were last year based on a couple new guys and the step that everybody had made because they had gone and played all these tournaments and lifted and done all those things. They wanted to get back, you know? And so I don't know if that answered the question or not, but
yeah. It set me up for another good one here. I don't know if you know this or not, but you hold the five longest, most consecutive win streaks in six of the like top seven, I guess it is. And so I think that's one thing that just kind of lends itself to a similar question, but it's like, you know, when you guys are winning a few in a row and everybody else in the country has one of those letdowns where it's either complacency or something else, like how have you guys been able to just weed those out and stay on these like tremendous runs when you know that entering games, you know, it's a team that's probably more talented that should win, but you just never had those letdowns that so many other peers would tend to have.
The hiccups. You know? Yeah. There's not been many hiccups here. I think there's a few reasons for that. And, you know, because we always have everybody's best, you know, going to get everybody's best effort.
Right.
You know, and that's gone on for forever here. I think it's the way we practice and how hard we practice. You know, like people even come to a pregame practice and they say, you know, you go to some kids' practice and they're walking through and say, oh, you got to go here and you got to do this. And, you know, they took a few shots and then they were done. Well, you come to our practice, it's not going to be very long day before a game, but the speed is going to be every bit the same as it was when we're going to play tomorrow. You know, we're going to shorten everything up, but if we do four or five clears, it's full speed. We do four or five man ups, it's full speed. We do the transition drill, it's full speed. We got to work on picks today. You're only going to do a couple, but man, you're getting after that dude and you're doing it right. And then, you know, I think back to what my son said when he inducted me into the National Hall of Fame in 2013. He said, the one thing that I always said out about my dad, and, you know, we never had this conversation. He said, it didn't matter who we were playing. And man, we played some cupcakes. Yeah. He said, but man, we knew everything about them. We were thoroughly prepared. He never took anybody for granted. And he did it the same way, regardless of who we were playing, so that if something did happen, it was on us. Not on him. It was on us. And, you know, I think that definitely helped out with it. You see the scout report for, you know, whoever we're playing. It doesn't matter. You know, it's pretty much the same level of intensity and preparation, you know, day in and day out, game in and game out, year in and year out that we always have had. And then I think once you get a culture where they're doing all this extra stuff, you know, we always talk about the bank account. You know, you got to put a lot of deposits in. You know, game days, time to make some withdrawals. And when you get to put the uniform on and you're going to make a withdrawal, you better play with a lot of pride. And our guys have taken, you know, that pretty literally here, you know, over the years.
Is there a game or a play or probably a call from a ref that you wish you could take back?
Well, I mean, you guys can go back and you guys can do it. You know, go back to the 2000, you know, six game and watch the end of the Cortland game. There was a lot of bizarre things that happened at the end of that game. I mean, one of them was a stupid thing on our part. You know, a player taking a shot that shouldn't have shot the ball when we were winning. You know, and their goalie was very, very good. And not to degrade it, but he probably wasn't the
most fit athletic dude, and he wasn't one guy that was going to be chasing around and double teaming people, you know, back in that day and age, and keeping you in the box. That wasn't going to happen. And, you know, player took a shot at open goal again, freak save. Cortland gets the ball back. You know, and then there was just some bizarre things, you know, a ball that goes out of bounds that, you know, I'm not going to name the officials. It's blatantly our ball, like blatantly our kid is a half step ahead of them and it gives them the ball, you know. Then they throw the ball the length of the field. The kid gets underneath. He clearly dives into the goal and scores. Maybe the rules were okay then, but man, he hits people. He's, you know, he touched every line and he scores a goal. You know, and to their credit, they took advantage of it and they did it and they got it done. But there was four or five things that all happened in a course of literally, 30 seconds. Only one thing had to go our way. And none of them did, you know, and we lost that game, and that would have been four in a row. But not only would have been four in a row, remember, 1-7-8, that would have led to six in a row. You know, the end of that game was bizarre. First play of the game, Mike Hurley is just he's a first-team All-American middie. Nobody can stop him. I mean, every shift, the kid's getting a point, like at the end of the season. Very first shift of the game, he missed the pass. He's going up through the midfield line. He's barely moving. He goes to reach for the ball. Nobody's even on him. And he blows his knee out. I mean, just bizarre things, you know, that happened that day in that game that, you know, we should have won. But the ending and a couple of the calls, whoa, you know, you still have nightmares about those things.
It's a great retrospective question. And I'm going to ask another one. And hopefully we can get you to indulge here, but if you want to, you know, lessen it, we'll certainly meet you somewhere in the middle. But who's the Mount Rushmore, the top four players to ever lace them up?
Well, there's a lot of really good guys, you know, but I got to go and mention one guy because I think it's almost criminal, and I hope it happens in my lifetime. Jason Kauffman is the greatest of friggin' all time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing even close to him, you know, and how that kid is not in the National Hall of Fame is beyond me. I mean, think about it. 4 years, four-time first-team All-American. 4 years, and I don't know how many games he played, because if he played this many games this day and age, he'd have about 900 points. The kid averaged 8.8 points a game for 4 years. You can't even fathom. So people just brush that off. Like, 8 points, you know. Well, think about that. Like, he was just unbelievable. He was unstoppable. His first game, one of his first games, were playing Nazareth, the defending champions. The defenseman of the year is guarding him. I think he had five at halftime. You know, I mean, he was unstoppable. And I was fortunate with that one too, you know, like the timing and all that stuff. You know, Carthage had just started lacrosse and Jason was the first 4 year player. Right. So, you know, some of my relatives, you know, said, "Hey man, you need to come, you get a hold of this Kauffman kid, man. He's really good, you know." And so we get him down here for a visit. I think he had visited Roanoke and a couple other places. He really liked it, and we had established a good relationship. So at the end of his senior year, I wanted to go up north anyway, see some family. So I wanted to go up, watch one of their playoff games. So I get up to Carthage and watch the cop. I don't know who they were playing, but you got to remember, Casey Powell's a sophomore in that team.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a couple other good kids that were really, really good that went on to play college basketball on that team too. You know, and I'm watching the game and I'm like, holy cow, he's got like 9 points today. He's got three around the back goals, so like four around the back assists. This kid's unbelievable. And I said, that other kid's pretty good too, running between the lines. A kid named Powell. But at that time, I mean, Casey wasn't even close. I mean, Jason was the man.
Right.
You know, and then Jason's brother comes along, and you know, everybody's recruiting Carthage, and because Casey goes there, and you know, his brother goes to Syracuse, and Josh, and has a great career, multiple All-American, wins championships. But like, you ask anybody, like, Josh is good,
love him to death, but like he wasn't no Jason, you know. Jason was legit. You know, he was pretty special, you know, pretty special. But there's a lot of other stories here. I mean, you know, Jake Berge playing 13 years for the Wings and his jersey's in the rafters, scoring 5 goals against Hobart as a freshman and winning the championship. You know, Kyler Berkman, MVP of the championship, 5-3 and player of the year, and Cross Ferrero, you know, there's just a lot of Johnny DeFazio, you know, the list goes on and on of just great, great guys, you know, that played here that were really, really special. I mean, Kyle Hartzell obviously had probably, you know, other than Jake, the most storied post career, but, you know, he didn't have the career here that those guys did. He had a special senior year, but, you know, Kyle, you know, it was a one and done for him at Salisbury. His junior year didn't play much, and then he was a JUCO player for 2 years. But man, he blew up his senior year, really got working hard. And, you know, you ask him about that, and he's the one guy that always talks about, like, working, and you know, he's got that culture and all that video he did. He'll tell you that this is where he got it. He got the work ethic.
2008, 2009, 2010 teams with Sam Bradman as some of like the most informative teams on my lacrosse fandom as well. Like, they were just so much fun to watch. They played so fast. There was so much like in transition, bigger, stronger, faster than everybody else. Put the ball on the ground and like balls in the back of the net in 10 seconds. Like, they were just so fun to watch.
Yeah. You know, Sam was a special player. You know, we were fortunate to get him because he had already committed to Hobart. And, you know, at the end of the journey, you know, his dad was a high school coach his dad actually called me, you know, and it was very late. I don't in his senior year, it was almost close to June, I think. And he said, you know, hey, look, I'm not going to spend $9 billion to go to where he was going. I might have been Hobart. He said for him to be a liberal arts major when he wants to be a teacher and a coach, which he is to this day. And so he called me. And the next thing you know, they come down to visit. It was like, man, we got Sam on board at the 12th hour. He was, you know, it all worked out for him. You know, he was only a freshman. It was really fun his freshman year, because even though we didn't get where we wanted to be, but watching him and my son Kyler play together on the first line, that was pretty special. some pretty special things happened when they were playing together. You know, but that team, those teams at the end of his tenure, you know, with Canone and Mendez, yep, and Crum on attack. I mean, you know, they were
Rodriguez in net,
pretty special, you know, at that end of the field. And Sam gets on a roll some games, man. He just couldn't be stopped.
Yep.
You know, and he was a lean kid, you know, and he had great work rate. You know, he could just, hey, you're up, Sam. Coach, I'm good. I'm up. You know, like, didn't need a second line. When we won in 12, or one, we beat Tufts really good. And London was the year before Cortland, the year after. You know, that year we weren't real good at midfield. We had 4 guys. And we're virtually at the end, in the heat, we were running 4-man midfield. Nobody else touched the field, and it was no problem for Sam. Yeah. You know, Lance Carter had evolved and it become a great player too. And, you know, that runs the Baltimore inner city group now. And, you know, they played every shift. Those guys were just such great athletes.
What made Preston Dabb so special?
You know, Preston's a story sort of like, in some ways, on the defensive end of Cross Ferreira. You know, Preston was 165. He was a 70-pound guy. And, you know, he was a face-off kid in high school and played a little defense. And, man, he showed up, man. He was just unbelievable. He was like, where that 15 pounds of... He had just worked his butt off in the weight room and extremely fast. Great side to side lateral movement, and then just tough as nails. Like, every shift you're probably in practice, he's winning it. He's doing his rep against you. He's not only winning it, he's making you feel the wrath.
Yeah.
You know, like, next time you're in line and you see him coming up, this is how intimidated your kid was. You're moving to another line. I don't need to go against him in a 2-on-2 pick play again. Like, hey, I'm going to subtly get out of that line so I'm not going against Dabbs again because I know he's going to jam the shit out of my hip. And there's a good chance if I go to get a shot, he's going to be up under my armpit and I'm going to be right on my butt. You know, he played like that every day. Just like Eric Martin. I mean, Eric Martin, you know, 2-time world team player, 14-year pro after his freshman year. Everybody said, how did Eric Martin not play as a freshman? Well, he came from Virginia Beach, Norfolk Academy. He was a man. I think they played a one-man backer zone. They just put Eric in the middle and said, Eric, you do whatever you want to do. You know, anybody slides, you slide to him. Eric, the clear this year is Eric Martin. Eric, get the ball, run the ball down the field. Well, it took us a whole year to get him out of that. Like, he didn't know, like, what to do on defense. Like, he just was always running at people because he never played man-to-man and everything. And, you know, on the clears, he'd get in trouble all the time, you know, because you can't run through everybody in college. But, man, the next year when he got it, whoa. You know, talk about probably the two of the best guys ever here day-to-day in practice on the defensive end of like, you're going to get their best every shift. Eric was on a mission every day. Like, I felt sorry for some of, like, either, like, the second attack guys the day before a game. Like, he would just go out there and beat the crap out of them every chance he got. He was very, very tough, played every shift like it was last. And you know what? You didn't want to touch the ball, you know, after he'd come on you.
And while I'm throwing guys at you as individuals, I'd be remiss at not to ask about one that is really close to myself and my family. That's Jimmy Creighton. Give us a little bit about Jimmy and his rundown as a player and a coach.
Jimmy just texted me yesterday, and Jimmy's solid. You knew he was going to be a great coach. You know, and well, there's stories kind of like, you know, you go back about some of the stories. So you got to throw Chase Caruso into this story. You know, because, you know, Chase, right, if you know Jimmy,
yep.
You know, Chase goes to what was a Sacred Heart, you know, and, you know, wins like 3 games first 2 years, and Jimmy's coming home, he's got a couple rings on his finger, and they're best friends, and, like, Chase says, this isn't fair, you know, this isn't fun, and then, you know, what happens, Chase comes, you know, comes player of the year. Jimmy just was a steady person, you know, not overwhelming in any one way, but just did a lot of things good, was very consistent, and, you know, and his claim is famed as a player, if we're talking about wins. I mean, he had 2 goals down the stretch, I think, in the last 3 minutes of that Middlebury game when we were down 2 goals that brought us back and won the game, which is probably one of those championship games we shouldn't have won. You know,
yeah, that's something he's let our high school team know about a thing or two.
Yeah, that was pretty unbelievable, the goals that he got at the end of the game and, you know, to bring us back and to win the game that we probably shouldn't have won. But just a great goal, made everybody around him accountable day in and day out, got better all the time, you know, and had a storied career.
Coach Justin Axel is the interim head coach. I think anyone who knows anything about this program knows how important he has been to it. Can you just talk a little bit about what he's going to bring to the table and how he can, you know, keep this tradition alive?
Well, you know, there's a few things. First of all, you know, Justin is a tremendous friend. And, you know, he's been a great colleague for a long time. And, I mean, I can remember because I was still in his office when he walked into my office as a junior in college, you know, and he wanted to help out, you know, and I was like, well, got to go out and watch a little bit. You got to pick up some balls and you got to do a lot of dirty work and you got to learn some respect from some people, because of the position you're in. And if you do all those things and then next year, we'll think about, you know, what the next step will be. And Justin did all those things, you know, as a 21-year-old, and because he really wanted this, you know, and started to earn the respect of all the players, got more responsibility the next year, then stayed on as my grad assistant, then got a job locally teaching and, you know, was my assistant for several years and just really wanted to be a great head coach. And then he got his chance at Eastern Connecticut, went up there for 7 years, I think it was. Did a great job, got him in the playoffs several times, had some really big wins. You know, and then finally, after, you know, I don't even know how many years I've been coaching, 14, 12, but well, I'd already been coaching 26 years and I never had a full-time assistant. You know, I had one GA, and the last couple of years before him, I had two GAs. We get a full-time assistant around 2014, and, you know, Justin wanted to come back and be that assistant because he felt that if he did that and everything continued and everything, he'd be in a better position to be the head coach. You know, and he's been my right-hand man, you know, for the last 12 years, and he's definitely checked all the boxes conceivably that anybody could think of, you know, to be the next head coach. Now, he's got a little journey to go through because we do have a state process, so he's the interim coach. You know, we have to go and interview a couple other people, but, like, he knows everybody in his program. He knows the alumni. He knows the local people. Players love him. They respect him. He's done so much for everything. I just hope that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'll be excited, more excited in 4 weeks when hopefully, because it's out of my, you know, job description or ability, that hopefully he's named the head coach.
How do you anticipate kind of staying involved in the program? You know, what will your role be?
Well, you know, I'm just finishing up here now until the end of July. And I'm just doing anything I can to help Justin, you know, and getting them all the forms. You know, he called me yesterday. Who do I find out in the MBA program to get somebody to help me with this? And, you know, I texted Christy Weir, the dean of the business school, because I got a relationship, and boom, you know, they got connected right away. And just little things like that, you know, like we talked the other day, I said, hey, you know, you're on the road a lot right now, and if you got a kid that's coming through here and you're not going to be here, and it's only, you know, because a lot of times we have these kids that come in on the weekend, and, you know, then they're flying back and they got Monday. Well, if you're at Naptown on Monday and a kid's not doing Naptown and this wants to come to campus, I said, you know, just let me know. I'll take him around, you know, do anything I can to help him and finish this up so he's in the best possible position, you know, when he hopefully is the new head coach.
What do you think you're going to miss most about coaching?
I think it's a couple things. I think number one, is that I enjoy practice. You know, I've always been a guy that's been able to manipulate drills so they meet the objectives and change them, you know, and get this new drill and create it and do those kinds of things. And, you know, I like making a difference and see people improve. That's just kind of been my big thing, you know. I enjoy that way more than game day. And then obviously, you know, all the guys and the people that I know and the relationships that have been created over the, you know, the 38 years. I mean, it's incredible the amount of people, you know. I just got a new phone like 6 months ago because mine broke down in school, right? And the guy goes, hey, do you know you got 10,000 contacts on this phone? I said, I knew I needed to upgrade my memory a little bit last time, but I didn't realize I had 10,000. So, you know, I've had the same phone number for quite a few years. And, like, you know, every time a kid visits and sits in that couch, you know, his phone number goes in my thing, you know, and where he's from and everything. And it's amazing, you know, it's amazing how many texts I've had from kids that didn't come here and said, hey, coach, you know what? I really respect you. I know that didn't quite work out, but man, what a career. I mean, that, you know, just, but, you know, obviously the relationships that on the day-to-day basis that get developed. But I'm also looking forward to touching back with some guys, you know, that I just never had time to, you know. It's three or four guys. Now, coach, when I come through now, now we can go have that beer together. You know, or we can get a cup of coffee, you know, that we never had time to do before. And, you know, and re-engage in some relationships that, you know, were so special.
What would be your advice to a young coach in his 20s that's kind of just getting started?
Well, obviously you got to get out there and you got to, got to get guys, you got to get players. And but, you know, some of these young guys, they go and they, you know, I see a lot of guys just watching guys all the time. Well, that's great. But man, nobody taught you anything about sales. You got to follow up. And it's got to be immediate. Hey, it's great that you got 14 guys. Well, I'm going to get back to the office in a week, and or you got 27 guys because I just went to 9 tournaments in a row and you're a young assistant. And then you come back 7-8 days later and then you start following up. No, like that day, I saw 4 great guys today. They got to get called. They got to get called. They got to get text tonight, you know? And then you got to follow through. You know, a lot of young kids aren't real, young guys aren't real good at the follow through part. You know, got to get them on campus. And our guys got to get him in that, get in that chair. I got to get him in that chair because he sits in that chair and he looks at that stuff. Man, the hook has started to get, he's taking the hook a little bit. But then they got to help guys get better. Like, they, you know, and I think that's how the relationship gets started, you know, and is that like, hey, you stayed out there or you went out on the wall and you went through a wall ball routine on a contact day with them. And, you know, you did some of the extra stuff, especially when you're younger, that they really respect you. Cause number one, they can see the skill that you have, you know, and they start to respect that. And, they can see that you're invested and, you know, that's important. And then you gotta be a person that people want to be around. You know, because you work hard, you do the right things, and then you treat them the right way. You know, I think we got some issues in D1 right now. Head coach is not treating the other guys so good, and now they can't keep people. Like, the guys that ever coached here, they got treated first class, you know, and my best, good friends, you know, every game for last year, and you know, we go and we all sit together. You know, and we're together after the game and, you know, having a beer, rehashing the game, talking about things or, you know, before the house burned down, you know, there was years, there wasn't many after games, we went to my house, you know, went in the backyard, sat by the fire and, you know, we had food and we talked and, you know, guys felt really welcomed. You got to make that staff believe in you and they got to want to die for you, you know, because you're invested in them. You know, if you treat them like crap and you don't do that, they're not going to get it done. But you know, we've done a good job treating guys well and they go on to be, you know, great head coaches. A lot of guys that left here are awful good coaches. One sitting there right behind me, you know, Jimmy Nestor, you know, Jimmy Nestor was my first captain, believe it or not. And, you know, but loyalty to them, got to work hard. And you can't, especially in D3, and this is not to degrade other coaches in any way, but if you go to a lot of D3 offices, I mean, even go to our office right now and you walk through this hallway, I don't think you see another coach here. You know, except there's one other guy here today, right now. And he's at the office behind me, and that's Coach Axel. Because Coach Axel learned that you got to get in here at 8:00 in the morning. You know, you got to be present. You know, a lot of coaches aren't present. They see other people doing things, and then they kind of get stuck into them. Well, you're trying to be special. You got to do more. And a lot of guys got to learn that too.
Coach, I know at various points in your career, you've had other opportunities. Well, you know, you could have gone coach D1 at various points. What all these years kept you at Salisbury?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that have done that. Number one, I don't know in any, again, these aren't in order. You guys have seen us play for several years. I mean, I've gotten to coach D1 players, got to coach world team players. I've gotten to coach pro players. So I've gotten to coach kids at a high level, you know, and teams at a high level. The COVID years when we coached these super teams, you see it right now. The level across the last year or two is not the same as it was 3 or 4 years ago when we had all these 24, 25-year-olds playing. You know, I've got to coach at an extremely high level. So it wasn't like, oh, I got to go coach D1 so I can coach this great guy. Well, I've coached a lot of those great guys. Two, I guess I just really love where I live. You know, I think that's important. You know, you come by my house today, 11:30, 11:45 it is today, I think. No, it's 11:30 today. There's going to be 8 people out in front of my house. And we're going to go ride for 21 miles. Like, I got my own bike club of friends that have nothing to do with lacrosse. You know, my dermatologist, she's a really good rider. She just retired. She'll be there today. And her husband, Dave Owens, who, you know, had his own company, and Dave Katowski, the head of housing here, he'll be there today. Mike Belukas, who's been my friend since I got here, that's an IT guy. We have our own little bike club, but we meet every day. Like, and then, you know, we go a half mile from my house and we're on a 20-mile loop where we don't see a car. Where do you do that? You know, I come back, take a shower, and I'm back in the office within 90 minutes. So, you know, the shore is a pretty special place. You know, it's about as close as I can get to being in the upstate and in the Adirondacks, and, you know, where you beautiful, you don't have a lot of traffic, got water, and you got a lot of things to do. So I think where I live, I really loved it. And, you know, growing up state in New York, when it used to be really, really cold all the time, I really appreciate the winters here. You know, people don't understand when I go out on my bike 360 days a year. Well, it's cold. Riding a bike at 34 degrees when you got the right gear on is not cold. But now riding at 34 below is cold, you know? And so I don't miss that part of living in upstate. But I'd sure like to be in upstate a few weeks in the summer, that's for sure.
Now, this has been fantastic. When are they going to build the statue of you on campus? Haven't talked about that yet.
Well, you know, I'm just a small piece of this, you know, puzzle that's turned out to be pretty good, and just be fortunate that Dr. Vellevance decided to get me back here, you know, in the fall of 88. And I was also fortunate, you know, Hank Jancic got the job here in 82, and, you know, I happened to meet this beautiful young woman that was very intelligent in my graduate school, named Jennifer, that's been my wife for 40 some years. So, you know, I've been blessed.
Well, now it's time for the, you know, the Berkman family adventures phase of your life. Enjoy it. You've accomplished so much, and it's been a joy to watch. And also, you've just been like fantastic ambassador for the game. So we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for all you guys do for the game, Dan. Appreciate you guys.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast. The source of the sport.